In the darkest worlds that ever were, the only thing that brings light are stories. Those stories are kept in one place, the tiny bookcase.
Hello, Story Seekers. I'm Ben.
I'm Nico, and you're listening to The Tiny Bookcase.
Welcome to the first of four special episodes, our Nano season.
In these episodes, we'll be discussing our progress through NaNoWriMo 2021, chatting to people going through it as well, and reading out some snippets of our stories.
For the first episode of this Nano season, we're joined by one of our favourite guests from season two, when he joined us with his harrowing tale written for the prompt The Giant.
We'd like to welcome back Benjamin Langley.
Hello.
How's it going? Welcome back to the bookcase.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. No, it's really good. Your story really stuck with me from season two. Just that pulling off of digits.
I do occasionally look at my toes and go, oh.
Is there a name for that phenomenon where you just sort of carry something with you that somebody else put in your mind?
Trauma.
Oh, yeah, that's it. You're trauma.
You're welcome.
What I like about that was you said that completely legitimately.
Yeah, man. That wasn't a setup. That what trauma? Because I've lived a completely happy life, Nico. That's what happened.
Oh, from the sound of it, it sounds like we're having a really good time already with this NaNoWriMo, Ben.
It gets to you.
So how is this Remo treating you?
Okay, I mean, we're only a few days in, but I wasn't working on Monday, so I ploughed into it then, got about 4,000 words done. And then that means the rest of the week when I am working, it's just adding a little to keep on top of the word count, and then I'll hammer into it again over the weekends.
Okay, so
yeah, that sounds good.
When you go over, do you say, okay, I've done, you know, 4,500 or whatever, so that's today and tomorrow and a bit of Wednesday or whatever? Or do you say, like, that's 4K, but I still have to do 1,600 tomorrow?
You can't help but think in days. You get very good at adding at 1,667 to each other and think, right, I'm there now. So in a couple of days' time, you kind of think, well, I know I'm not going to get much done on Wednesday or something. So, well, I need to get a little more done then. And I know the end of the month is going to be particularly hectic. So really, I'd like to hit 50K around the 20th. So a challenge.
Okay, bit of a challenge. So we have talked about it on previous episodes, but just if anybody is joining us for the first time right now, like NaNoWriMo, it's a writing challenge month where the goal is to write 50,000 words in the month of November.
Why would you do that, Ben?
Yeah, why would you do that? Well, to end up with a bit of a book, I guess. Like 50,000 isn't. Anyway, that aside. So the point is to write around 1,600 words a day for the whole month, and that will end up with you having about 50,000 words. So a lot of people try and do that, but then also there's, as Ben said, he's very busy, so he wants to move the word count around, which is, I think that probably requires a bit more steel in your stomach to do. I think it's a bit, possibly a bit easier to write just a smaller amount of words every day.
You tell that to my fingers.
Yeah? Are you getting bloody fingers on your keyboard?
It's a strange thing. You know, for this podcast, we write, and there's a ceiling that if we get there, it's then, oh, I need to take things away. Mm. And to suddenly invert that and go, no, if you haven't got there, you haven't done it yet, kick in a bit more.
Yeah. So,
it's pretty wild.
It's a totally different purpose a lot of the time. Yes, and there are those awful moments when you are thinking too much about the word count and you put something in and you think, that's just padding. And you know it's going to have to come out again in the future, but, you know, the words count for now.
You know, you look at it, you go, okay, I've written 1,654. and they were wearing a hat, and the hat was really rather big considering the size of their head. Cool.
But go back that's in and add a few adjectives.
Or you do what I did yesterday, which was just needlessly put in a few descriptions of some rather explicit nudity just to end the day out well. That one was just for me.
What better way to end the day?
You'll enjoy that again on its way to the editing room floor.
I can already hear it hitting it. Oh, yes. Oh, that's brilliant. So I'm glad it sounds like it's going well. So we're, just so people are aware, we are day 4 as of recording. This will be coming out on the Monday. So we theoretically had 4 days of writing around 1600 words. So I think I'm just under 10K at the moment.
Wow.
Just because, you know, there's that first day buzz where you're like, oh, I could do this for ages. And you push out a lot of words, and then you just watch your daily word count slowly freefall towards exactly the amount you need to get done for that day.
I didn't get that first day buzz.
No?
As it's, you know, it's come up on the podcast before that I'm a musician, and I was on tour until the 31st of October. That was the last show. So I went from a really intense 2-week tour playing every single day to all of a sudden, and now you're a writer again. And my brain just couldn't do it. I was like, how do stories go? Is it verse, chorus, verse? No, that's not stories.
Amazing.
But it's coming back. It's sliding back in slowly.
So I think the crux of it is that we still like to tell stories and stuff on this podcast. So although none of us have short stories to read today, I think we've all got something from these works in progress that we'd like to, read out and maybe get a bit of feedback on and a bit of a chatter around where our head was at, possibly identify and point out, oh, that's the padding. There it is. That's coming out. So who'd like to go first?
Go on. I'm the virgin.
I'll jump in. For a moment there. Okay. Take it away, Nico.
Right, so to explain what I'm going to read out, I'm introducing a species in my world here. First time I've had to do that because, you know, normally you write down goblin and most people have a vague idea of what a goblin is, which is, you know, quite helpful if you're writing goblin and dwarf and orc and people fill it in for you. Thanks, Tolkien, you really set us up there. So this happens partway into the book before the first sort of combat, which is also, we may come back to that at some point, but it's our errant heroes, Prig and Scab, are joined by Edmund, a human warrior, and some orcs who are sort of chaperoning them. But this is an introduction of a race, and I thought it'd be interesting to read because I don't know if it does read well, and it might just be a bit unnecessary, so I'll read it out, and then we'll have some feedback. Blutbaum, whispered Edmund, inviting the all-encompassing silence to bugger all the way off, and the large portion of hell that waited in the wings to unleash itself with reckless abandon. As, reader, I assume you are not well-versed in the sentient flora that skulk the dense woods of the Imperial Fringe, and it must be said at this juncture, most are not, the most well-informed xenobiologists normally occupy that position shortly after saying something along the lines of, well, I didn't know they could do that, and very briefly before never saying anything else ever again. Here will be an excellent place to explain the Blutbaum. There is no goblinoid word for them, though they would be referred to by Prig and Scab later as a bad time all round. Blutbaum are an unfortunate byproduct of a society that does most of its business behind buildings and the rest of it behind the back of unsuspecting passers-by. When the unfortunate, unskilled, or generally unlucky meet a foul end in the wooded places of the world, what's left of them has to go somewhere. The gold, boots, and anything that someone in a tavern might give you a coin for generally makes its way away from the forested areas. But the juicier parts tended to make their way down. Trees, lovely though they are, are not discerning when it comes to appetite. And before you know it, many a root has supped on person's soup. Water does good things to trees, makes them happy. Blood, I'm afraid to tell you, brings out the worst in trees, who turn out to be spiteful sods, who luckily for us, tend to get stuck in one place most of the time. We say, most of the time, as the saplings produced by these crimson-fed crops come out rather boisterous. They grow into the Blutbaum. Filled with the sorrow and the rage of the dead, these trees seek to make more kin, reclaim the woods from intruders, and generally make themselves a bloody nuisance to anyone without bark for a bum.
Oh, what an ending.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, it was a fun tone. It's good that we got it situated, I think. And this is a continuation. You're actually writing the rest of the novel of the section that you read out a couple of episodes ago, I think.
I am, the two little goblin fellas.
Goblin fellows, yeah. So this idea of effectively like a blood tree nymph.
Yes, of a blood dryad type thing.
Blood dryad, yeah, that was the one I was looking for, yeah. I like it. I like the tone that you tell it in as well, that kind of encyclopedic voice.
It's sort of accidentally gone a very Hitchhiker's Guide direction, hasn't it?
I don't think that was ever going to be... not saying it was deliberate, but it was never in doubt that your writing was going to be influenced by Douglas Adams.
That's fair.
And I think this worked well. It was fun. It felt like an interesting interlude from there, what we know the goblin story sounds like. I liked it. I thought it was a cool creature. It was funny. I think it had all the cool ingredients that we need from it. What do you reckon, Benjamin?
Yeah, I agree entirely. When you do some kind of a intrusion like that, you've got to get the tone right, and I think you've got a really great tone for it. It's as Ben said, encyclopedic, almost Attenborough talking about these creatures and their habits. So the language choices that come across are spot on for that kind of knowledge. And a phrase many a root has supped on person soup. It's just delightful.
Yeah. And it does, obviously not to break down the joke too much, but it is a primordial soup that these beings are being created from as well, which is kind of cool. I like the implications for the world as well, that things can just happen like this. Beings can just spring into existence because something bad happened in a forest.
Yeah.
I think it has interesting implications. And as Benjamin just said about the authorial intrusion, my understanding is that's something that you're going to be doing quite a lot through the book.
Yes.
So I think it's good to see an example of it and an example of it working here.
We'll come back to it next week. It's been an interesting sort of balancing act. There are moments they have a bit more emotional weight, albeit that every single time they're completely over the head of the goblins. There are people talking about really serious problems, and these two little sods just don't understand at all. But to have those moments where the author is pulled out a little bit and this sort of snarky voice vanishes, it's been quite a challenge. Sort of messing with the authorial voice and knowing where that does go and where to pair it back. So I'm glad it works there.
We were talking earlier about padding. I didn't spy any really there. But I suspect it could theoretically become quite an interesting tool for inflating your word count artificially, couldn't it? This authorial intervention, these intrusions, because. We were joking earlier about suddenly just describing a hat in detail in order to hit the word count for the day. You could sort of be like, and then this, this particular hat was made of this particular, all this.
It could go,
but I didn't spot any of it there. So I think that's.
How meta is it to start getting to? And then the goblins, realizing that there were still 30 or so words needed for the day.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, I'm excited to hear more of that next week for sure.
Yeah, I think with having characters like the goblins who are unaware of so much of what's going on around them, you need another voice in there that is the expert. And you're asking the reader to kind of really kind of think and read between the lines, which is great because you don't want to tell them everything. But that's I really like it. Very nice.
Oh, I feel all warm and cozy now. Lovely. Yeah.
Delightful. Nice and short snippet. I think we've got some longer bits now. Would you like to go next, Benjamin, or shall I go and then...
I'm happy to go next.
Go for it.
Okay, so I'll just contextualise a little. This is from Guy Fawkes' Demon Hunter, Book 1. This is the first encounter with a demon. It's about Chapter 4 of the piece. We've got Guy Fawkes in the piece and his friend Kit Wright, who have just started school. They are roughly 7 years old. They have followed a cat innocently into a farmhouse, and we will see what situation that puts them in. A character is introduced towards the end called Oswald, who's an older boy at the school who they mistrust. They've been following him, and he's been doing some rather suspicious things. So we will pick it up from here. When Guy awoke, he was on the other side of the thick, twisted willow branches. Wooden prison no more than a yard and a half square. It shared his prison, standing at the front, gripping the branches. He struggled to his feet and shuffled beside Kit, his face illuminated red and flickering as the fire in the fireplace burned brightly. I turned to the flames and stared. There was always something about fire that suggested the idea of home. I could stare until he lost all track of time, all sense of meaning. Help me! It struck Guy on the arm. That's when he realised he was trying to force the branches apart. The wood was hot from the proximity to the fire. Still, Guy gripped hold of it and pulled and pushed and twisted. Even with the combined force of the two of them, wood barely bent. He's awake! Came a high-pitched and squeaky nasal voice from across the room. He wore a robe, a dark hood covering most of his face. The bottom of the robe, which brushed the stone floor, rippled. From within the folds of the robe, cat emerged. He crouched and stroked the cat's head, purred in response. And I have you to thank for bringing me two sacrifices. Ammon will reward me for this gift. He took a paring knife from the table, turned to the boys, and smiled, revealing blackened and twisted teeth. He replaced the knife, picked up a chunk of chalk, and got down on his knees. The view obscured by his kidnapper's body, Guy knew not what he was drawing. He started to chant. I remained in the dark. A few of the words were familiar from their Latin lessons, but nothing that could be comprehended. Log crackled in the fire, volume of a clap of thunder, and the room brightened. From the corner, the robed man dragged a sack. The second he moved it, whatever was within writhed. From the sack, he pulled out a rat, clenching it tightly in one hand. It squealed as he reached for the knife and plunged it into the rat's belly. Blood ran over his fingers and onto his chalk pattern. I could see now it was some kind of five-pointed star. A moment's pride at being able to count five hit him before the peril of the situation returned. It continued shaking and yanking at the twisted branches of the wooden cage to no avail. Guy watched the blood drip from the rats and followed the chalk path along the floor. When the rat was drained, the man tossed the carcass into the flames, stilled as if time had been frozen for them. I stared at the stationary orange tips of the fire. I've seen fires burn so often, but never still. Black smoke billowed from the fireplace, swirling around the room as if it had its own instinct before coming together in front of the fireplace in the form of something almost human illuminated by the still flames. Smoke creature solidified, turning from smoke to ash to charred and leathery flesh. It was taller than the average man, even more so as a result of the goat-like horns on top of its head. Its arms, legs and trunk were particularly thick, and twisting from the rear was a tail ending in a barbed tip. The robed man fell onto his knees and bowed down. "Dark Master, hear my plea!" Fire burned inside the eyes, and when it opened its mouth to speak, a row of pointed teeth were revealed. "Filthy, pock-marked denizens of this foul, swamp-scented land, why do you call Mammon here?" The robed man continued to bow. "Demon Master, I am all you allege, and more. Great hardship has fallen upon me. My farm is in ruins. I offer you this feast in exchange for but a small fraction of the wealth of hell." Mammon became smoke once more, darting across to the cage where he reformed. I watched, wonder trumping fear. This was a demon, dragged up from the fiery pits of hell he'd heard mentioned so often at church. He couldn't take his eyes from the hideous beast. Despite his body turning against him, involuntary trembling, the blood pumping through his veins so quickly, he half expected it to fly from the ends of his fingers. "Puny vermin-looking pizzle drops! This is a feast not for the very lowest of demon spawn, let alone a lord of hell." It was smoke once more, before reappearing in front of the robed man. "What more offers thou?" The robed man bowed. "Anything you desire, darkest master." "And your soul, your very soul shall be mine to do with as I please when your time is done on this plane." Yes, master, anything you desire." "First I eat, then sign your name in the black book." Mammon clicked his fingers. On the table, a weighty tome appeared, falling open to a blank page near its centre. Mammon reappeared by the cage and placed one hand on a twisted branch, crumbled to ash. He touched another, destroying it in the same way. Another branch crumbled. So long, he'd tried to break free of them, but now Guy wished they'd still remain. As he tested the gap to see if his arm could fit through, the farmhouse's door flew open. Light pouring in from the door behind him, his pale skin and near white hair made it obvious it was Oswald, dressed in a similar robe to the kidnapper, and no doubt there to join in the demon celebration. Then he spoke. Back, foul servant of Satan!" Mammon swirled back into smoke, reforming before Oswald, and flexed his fingers. In the ether, a handle solidified, several lengths of knotted cord hanging from one end. He flicked his wrist, bringing flame to the cords of the cat o' nine tails. "Master!" the robed man called. "Rid us of this intruder so we can complete our pact." Oswald withdrew a sword. Mammon grinned. "Your mediocre weapon has no chance here, you weedling boy, you coxcomb. Fall to your knees and pledge allegiance to me." It tugged on Guy's sleeve and indicated the gaps in the front of the cage. While it was barely wide enough for a hulking demon's arm, 2 7-year-olds with a desire to cling on to life could squeeze out. Oswald held his weapon in front of his face, vertically, pointing up to the ceiling. Bright light consumed the blade. Iron Kit had no choice but to look away. When they could return their gaze, the weapon had tripled in size, the blade retaining a blue glow along its sharpest edge. All along the blade, golden symbols continued to shine. Mammon flicked his whip, but it fell short of Oswald. Guy and Kit continued to edge along the wall, away from the cage, but then a pair of orange eyes fell on them. Cat hissed, drawing the attention of their kidnapper. master, he called. Your beast is escaping. Damon turned. Oswald took advantage, reaching once more into his robe, plucking something from the pouch attached to his belt. Draw a circle with this and stay inside it. Oswald tossed a vial across the room. It lunged. The glass hit the palm of his hand. Before he could close his fingers, it bounced out, spinning into the air again. I ducked and reached with both hands and let the vial fall into them. Damon had disappeared. The robed man had hold of the knife. He grinned at the boys. I pulled the cork bung from the bottle and quickly poured it in a circle around both himself and Kit. Oswald darted across the room, grabbed the man's robe and whipped him around. Blades flashed as the two commenced combat. Smoke swirled around the perimeter of the circle. Mammon came to flesh once more. He gazed at the floor, looking for a breach in the circle. He flicked the cat o' nine tails. It arched back, trying to duck it, but it hit an invisible wall above the circle. Kit fell onto his bottom and Mammon reappeared on that side of the circle. Kit had fallen inside. Come out! Come out, and I shall reward you with such delights that you have never before tasted. Damon flicked his fingers. The whip disappeared. In its place was a cake, still piping hot as if straight from the oven. As delicious as the cake looked, Damon could not penetrate the circle. Maybe riches beyond imagination would appeal. Cake disappeared, replaced by more coins than the beast could carry. They fell from his clawed hand and clattered onto the floor, rolling to a stop at the circle's edge. Get thee back to hell! The demon's actions had kept their attention from Oswald. The robed man was felled. Oswald had pulled another vial from his belt and threw it at the demon. Before it could hit him, he dissolved into smoke. The liquid continued through the air, penetrating the circle and drenching Kit and Guy. Let's go, Oswald cried, rushing for the door and holding it open. I was out first and Kit close behind him. He reached the edge of the farmstead, past the stables and slowed. Don't stop, Oswald cried. I did. He turned to see Oswald. Close. Oswald tried to swerve out of the way. Seeing the older boy hurtling towards him, Guy too took evasive action, and the two of them came together, Oswald's knee connecting with Guy's head. He collapsed onto the ground in a heap. Not that Guy knew a thing about it. He was out cold.
Oh man, what an exciting scene. Like, it really captured the excitement of it. Loved it. The whole way through, I was really enjoying the concept that the title promised, and then the way that you were delivering on it was really fun.
I like Baby Guy Fawkes stars in Hellraiser. Yeah. I'm here for this, man.
Yeah. It's definitely really fun.
Spikes to show you.
Yes.
I find these fantastical reframings of history. I was trying to think if I've got any other examples of it inside my sort of like literary awareness, but I don't think I necessarily, like, I've read some historical fiction and that kind of thing, but this isn't quite the same thing, is it? This is adding a genre to a historical figure. So the closest I could come to it was that movie a while back, which was Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yes, there was. And they did a few Jane Austens.
Pride, Prejudice and Zombies.
And yes. Sensibility and Sea Monsters is my favourite of those.
Oh, amazing. And it's always a fun thing to do, I think.
It's got big, young Indiana Jones vibes. And I say that with nothing but love.
Oh, crad.
Yeah. I'm also a big fan of old insults. And dropping the coxcomb on someone was pure bliss. I thought that was great.
That was one of the fun parts, kind of revisiting my kind of Shakespearean insults and dragging things from there. And yeah, I think most of the demons are going to be foul-mouthed in a very 1500s, 1600s way, I think, because why not?
I think Marlo would be proud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Marlo may well actually make an appearance in book two.
So I was just about to ask you, like, it feels to me, because the thing that I got really excited about, on top of the actual, like, action of the story, was this idea of other real historical people turning up in the framing device that you've got of this, like, this demon hunter approach. So, like, you know, the gunpowder plotters, like Catesby, you've got the playwrights at the time, because this is, like, if Guy Fawkes is, like, is a child, then what's this, like, 1580 or something like that?
He was born in 1580, so book one basically takes us from his birth to 16. That's all set within York. Book two takes us outside of the city, and it's largely based upon kind of various key events within his life, which, to be honest, his young life is mostly people he knew and was close to dying. So it's awful.
So is it because they got by demons?
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't want you to ruin it. Don't ruin it. But yeah, it sounds really exciting. I love the concept, and I can really see it working. Yeah.
Please tell me that, you know, all these kinky cat of nine tail demons are going to be. This is leading up to him joining the Spanish Catholic army to go and fight all these Dutch horny demons.
I mean, yeah, I've got all three books very loosely plotted out, because this month I'm working on book two. I've got more of a plan for the first half of that. But yeah, book three, basically, the subtitle is a Diabolical Plot, starts when he goes onto the continent. So yeah, we've got kind of the first part of that is the Spanish army, King Philip and his corruption, then back to England for the gunpowder plot, King James, etc.
Explosive.
Yeah, indeed.
King James, Demon Lord.
it's one of the things which started me on this was discovering that King James wrote a book called Demonology.
He was obsessed with witchcraft and demons.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why in the story itself they think that actually there might be some hope in him as a monarch.
My understanding is that his obsession with this kind of thing is one of the reasons why so many demons and witches started appearing in Jacobean theatre.
Yeah.
Just because they knew that it was like he was into that genre, you know? So people started making that kind of, you know, changing their work to have that in it. It's pretty fun.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Just kind of let's turn up the supernatural because we know it will please our king.
Yeah, and it's sort of nice to know that people don't change, whether it's in the, you know, the sort of early 17th century or the modern day. Like, sooner or later, if you're making media, then you are going to be trying to please somebody. May as well be the king, I guess.
Why not?
So speaking of, like, who you're trying to please here, is your intention to go sort of YA with it, or is the sort of, like, because I know it must be difficult writing the early years of a character.
So the way that I'm trying to kind of pitch it is that the book one is more kind of a coming of age story, so kind of with kind of an adult kind of horror / fantasy readership.
Okay.
Because books two and three certainly are going to be when Guy Fawkes is an adult. So if book one is pitched solely at YA, it does make it hard for book two and three.
Yeah.
Bloody history.
This is probably really way too specific question, but how dangerous are demons in this world? Like, are they might make you kill your family, or they might make you kill the world? What are we talking here? Or is it tiered in that classic Christian way?
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's there are various tiers. Some of which are basically the purpose of all demons. within is to cause chaos, to bring mayhem to Earth in some way. That's why they tend to prey on people who are in power, because they are more likely to be able to turn the world upside down. When when commoners try to call demons, they tend to be not as strong demons who are tempted by them, and they just kind of tend to corrupt them and play with them for fun. Yeah, there's a lot of death.
I'll take it.
Definitely. Right, well, I shall do some reading then.
Next beneath the kosh is thou.
Indeed. So, yeah, this is, to give this a bit of context, a bit of situated in the text sort of thing. For this bit that I'm reading out, I've got multiple sort of main characters in the novel that I'm writing at the moment. And this is the introduction to the third character in the book, the third main character in the book, if that makes sense. So I sort of picked it because I wanted to sort of see... It sort of works on its own to a certain degree, I think. There's a bit of world building in here relative to the character. And I guess we'll see how it goes. Sort of gets an idea of who she, hopefully gets an idea of who she is, what her bit of the story is about, and what's going on where she is. So, Leora pulled the rain cloak tight to her as she flitted across the main street. She could feel the weight of the package she carried against her chest. It reassured her. The rains in the Gore were near constant during the winter. The bitter cold was dreaded by everyone, even the locals. Instead of braving the streets, the tower mages, nobles, and well-off merchants made use of carriages. Leora had to avoid one as it splashed past her. The contraption caused a wave of the icy water that pooled at the edges of the cobbled road to cascade over the top of her boots. She felt the dirty slush drench her woolen socks, and when she took another step, she heard that her footfalls were now accompanied with a squelching noise. "Fuck!" she shouted, startling some of the other raincloak-swaddled pedestrians. She left them quickly behind as her path took her through the next alley and down a wind that curved between a brothel and a textile workshop. As she passed, she heard a cacophony of panting groans from one side and a foreman shouting orders from the other. No doubt, she thought, the whorehouse's noises provided a decent incentive for the labourers sweating their way through their shifts across the way. Though the noises were horribly fake, they stirred up her own passion with distracting reminders of how long it had been since she'd put someone on their back. The Gore was always busy with every trade known to humanity. The city had taken shape where the eastern and western coast roads met in the north. The Gore was a melting pot for the cultures and people that came from all over Berrand, and even beyond. Leora had spent most of her childhood down by the cold docks trying to rub two coins together, and as such she'd seen more than most women her age. The Gore, she reckoned, despite never having seen anywhere else, was the centre of the world. The package she bore was the culmination of a year's work, and not just her work either. Leora didn't let herself dwell on how she would achieve her goal once she had the money. The heavy package seemed to vibrate next to her chest, and she pressed it firmly against her ribs. As she exited the wind, she looked left and right quickly, allowing the hood of her cloak to flick water droplets from its ridge. She caught a glimpse of a purple belt as she did so. A Medi man was absent-mindedly cleaning his nails at the mouth of an alley to her right. It was then that she began to know that she was in trouble. Leora didn't hesitate. She simply carried on at the same pace she had been using to navigate the back streets of the Gore. Purple, here, was a bad omen. The Medi family controlled the dye industry in the city, and it was one of the main exports of the Gore. Gorian purple, she knew, was derived from the snails that clung to the sea rocks in the wide bay of the Gore. The Medi family had used the wealth they had amassed from the natural resource to build a trade empire along the dockfront and on the high mercantile streets of the Gore. Their initial criminal activities had been aided by rogue mages, it was said. 20 years ago, however, during the gang war that nearly burned half the city down, she knew that the Medi family had betrayed those rogue mages to agents of the Tower in exchange for help in winning, and had achieved legitimate trading contracts thereafter. The Gore, whilst ostensibly controlled by the Tower, was a bustling trade and port city in a way that differed hugely from the bridge and mesa sprawl which she had heard surrounded the Tower itself in southern Berrand. The Medi family had been the answer to the Tower's dilemma on how to administrate and profit from the distant Gore. As such, Leora had grown up in a city controlled by the Medi family. Hexa, the matriarch of those Medis, was officially the mayoress of the Gore, and she held the office seemingly at the behest of the mages. Yet, Hexa was queen as far as most of her people were concerned. Her purple sash-wearing enforcers were known as Medi-men, and they were known to act quickly on intelligence gleaned from the family's criminal contacts when their control was threatened. Over the sound of the rain cascading from the gutters above her, Leora could hear a woman humming peacefully inside one of the buildings she walked past. The sound reminded her of pleasant times of contentment she had never experienced, the childhood memories she had never owned. As a child, she'd thought of what life must be like for those people who were living normal lives. Fathers smiling at their children on the rug, mothers humming as they prepared food in the next room. She wondered how different she would be as a person had she had a warm and loving environment. The intensity of the rain picked up and it began to hiss down over her head and spurt out of the overburdened gutters in great waterfalls. The humming was lost to her as her boots skidded around the next cobbled corner. Leora had grown up in the Cogturner housing with her mother and Callie, her mother's husband. Her mother, she remembered, had once been bright-eyed, but she'd never had the energy to hum a tune. Her mother's job had caused her to leave early in the day and come back only just in time to sleep before the next one began. Callie had stayed with Leora during that time. He had taught her to read, write, and do sums. His face had often held a gentle smile, but he too had never hummed for his own amusement. His own work took him out whilst Leora's mother was asleep. Leora knew that his time had been spent in a purple sash. She'd been told ever since she could understand the words that the world was dangerous for her, that she must always wear her wooden amulet, that she would suffer if she ever let her guard down. As her mother had degenerated further and further towards the shambling stereotypes of the Cogturners, Leora's passion for life had grown exponentially. She had begun to spend more and more time beyond the confines of the Cogturner housing. She'd engaged in seasonal work along the docks since she was 10 years old, making a few hard-earned coins. She had spent them with friends she'd made on those jobs. They trawled the alehouses and backstreet theatres, finding amusement where they could. Leora found that she liked the city. As she had grown up, she had taken lovers from amongst her groups of friends and experienced life with those people for a time. Though the intensity of enjoyment she felt from that kind of thing still clanged its summoning bell regularly, it had begun to ring hollow against her lack of purpose. It was then that she'd taken stock of what she wanted from life. It had come to her quickly. She wanted to help her family, and so she had set to the task of finding the gaps in the markets of the Gore. Initial investments of funds she received for her hauling work on the docks had gone well. She'd always been drawn to the Electrum the mages prized so highly. As her coins came in, she began to buy it up, as many of the scraps of metal as she could find. Her gut told her that it would be valuable at the right time. She stockpiled one sliver of the stuff at a time over the years, until she'd accumulated enough for a few small bars. She heard people were getting caught siphoning off the power from the Cogturner's sheds. Their intentions were to sell it to a whole host of interested parties for likely enormous profits. The dangers of getting inside a Cogturner's station were enough to put most people off. Usually, the purple-sashed Medi brutes were enough to handle such crimes against the way of the world. Yet, those she spoke to about it whispered of the Finder Mages being deployed as the attempts became more and more common over the continent. Wherever there were Cogturners, she had heard, you would find someone now willing to take the risk and siphon. Leora's own take on the activity had differed drastically from those approaches, and she was damn proud of it. Leora had gained access to the Cogturner shed her mother was assigned to, and when inside, she'd covertly studied the stations. It had not taken long afterwards to fashion the device she required. Every night thereafter, after Callie left, she would place the siphon device she had constructed in her mother's hands before she slept. Every morning, she made sure to remove the device before Callie returned. He was an uncomplicated man, and Leora had withheld her plan from him, as she knew he would not understand. She'd not wanted to siphon too much from her already tiring mother, and so it had taken nearly a year to fill the electrum rod which was connected to the siphon. The rod itself had been beyond her skills to make, and was styled after a drawing of one she'd bought years ago. The smith she had paid to fashion it had remained quiet during the forging, but after he was done, he had withheld the piece until the danger pay matched the risk. She had paid the man a second time, but privately had sworn vengeance in her heart. She carried the precious rod, filled with power, wrung from her mother, close to her chest. It was wrapped in soft fabric, and then she had further protected it by swaddling it in a waterproof leather, creating a small soft bundle with a dangerous core. The price she intended to collect from her buyer that night would be enough for her to purchase her family a house on one of the nicest streets in the Gore. She would be able to give her mother a place to rest and recover from her days as a turner. She would be able to give Callie a place to be proud of, a place to put his feet up by the fire. Leora's mind bumped back to reality as she saw a purple-sashed Mediman stood 30 feet from her at the exit of the alley she had intended to take. Leora knew that before she could achieve her daydreams, she would need to make it to the sale first.
The through line of the purple really fucking works in that section. Really, really works. I don't know if it's because the innate knowledge of how expensive purple dye was, and sort of already knowing about that, but it brings that scene to life. That little bit of the world.
Mm.
Yeah, it's that really enjoyed that.
Yeah, especially as that there's so much kind of rain and gloom and misery and kind of these cobblestones there. But we can see kind of where the wealth is through that too. So it's a nice touch.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you can really see very clearly on that, well, I think I can see it clearly, is that it has way less polish than the stuff that I normally put out, because this is literally, I wrote this 2 days ago. This was about hitting the word count for 1 day of the NaNoWriMo. So, you know, we talked about it a lot earlier about padding and stuff, and even whilst I was reading it, I was thinking I would lose this sentence, I would chop this one in half, you can feel your editing brain begin to engage, but what we've got there is just raw words on a page from me this week.
It's an interesting thing to be doing, because I think we're all coming at this, obviously, for this NaNo season, as I'm not going to look at any of these stories as though they're a finished product. So for me, it was the things that I liked jumping out at me, rather than sort of thinking about, does that work, or do I like that? Because there's definitely some pearls in there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I'd take from that. Could it do with editing? Almost certainly. So could what I read. There's a foundation of something really nice in there, and it is really densely atmospheric. And not just in the scale, the small scale of the scene you're in, but the world that you're building. It does a lot of legwork.
Yes, it does. Yeah, when you introduced the piece and talked about how this was kind of a third point of view character, you were going to be kind of establishing that character there. You've not just established that character, you've established her as part of this world too. So she feels very much part of this city. I think that meant her character comes across so much more strongly. And there were so many little things in there that I was thinking, okay, what's that? That's cool. Like the package. Well, what is it? What's she doing? And we find out a little more about her life and how she's earning money. The goal, the amulet, the electron rod. I think you mentioned that when you read the first part of this several weeks back. I seem to remember that was an important aspect too. And we see that coming across there. So there's so many kind of bits and pieces of intrigue. And really the last thing to worry about when you're trying to get words down is going back and editing it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're entirely correct. The rod that's mentioned here is very similar to the one that's mentioned in the prologue section, which I read out a few episodes ago now. But with this character, we sort of see the underside of society, in a way that we didn't in that prologue. You know, this is like a knockoff rod that she's been basically draining her mother of life force of in order to fill it.
Yeah.
So I like this introduction because it shows that she, whilst her goals are, you know, a little bit childlike, I guess, but also well-intentioned.
Well, relatively noble, yeah.
Relatively noble, like the way that she's chosen to go about it, because she's so desperate and she's in such like a poor situation, she's basically advancing the generation of her mother in order to save her mother. It's very, I feel like it's got a lot of drama to it. And that's
totally.
And that's why she's careful. You know, it's a metal rod. It doesn't need to be wrapped in soft fabric and then swaddled in waterproof leather. You know, it's sort of showing that this is really, nothing can happen to this. Nothing can go wrong for her. This is her one shot that she's been building up to for a really long time.
I think after you, then, please.
What's really cool about this concept as well is when you're trying to make a character interesting, you think about, well, what's the line that they wouldn't cross? How far would they go with something? Then you push a bit further and think, well, would they? And with her draining her mother, that seems to be like a line that most people wouldn't cross. If she needs to, then yeah, that seems like a really kind of powerful, there'd need to be a powerful motivation in there for somebody to do something like that. So that's really cool.
If anything, it's one of the first things, it's almost a joke, isn't it? Like, you know, if you say that someone would sell their own mother or sell their own grandmother for something.
Yeah.
She opens by having transgressed a fairly cardinal rule, which is to not take advantage of your parents.
I think that piece worked better in the context, the sort of wider context of having had another character introduced from a very different background already. So because I've been lucky enough to read and have had you read the start of your... Oh, no, you didn't read the start out, did you? You read the prologue.
This is
stuff I've read and you guys haven't. So, having had the context of having another character introduced, the sort of first lead, and how different their background is, and what they're surrounded by, that was running in my mind while you were reading that.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, as a pairing, and it would appear a trio, it's painting the greater picture of the world very well.
I'm glad. I think, you know, it does do everything that I wanted to do, and I don't think it's bad for a first effort, but it is clunky as hell as far as I'm concerned. I think it needs a huge amount of polish. But just to go back to what we were saying earlier, that's not what this month is about. Like, this month, because when you just push out words, even if when you're writing it, some of it sounds like padding, when you go back to edit, it feels like sometimes you're like, oh, actually, that bit's quite good. If I expand it in that way instead of the way that I've done it there, it could actually be useful instead of padding.
Sometimes it's honestly as simple as, what if that sentence was three sentences earlier? Fuck, that's so much better.
Yeah.
I love when it happens.
Yeah.
And also, really hate myself when it happens.
So the only other thing, this is more general. It's not necessarily for this thing, but I just wanted to ask you, Benjamin, and Nico as well, for your opinion. But basically, if you have named locations in your work, and like, how do you stop yourself from referring to them constantly when you're describing them? Because I feel like when I was reading that out, I was always saying the gore or the tower over and over and over again in a way that I might find quite irritating if I was reading it on a page or even listening to it. Like, is there
That is interesting. I think sometimes it's about restructuring some of those sentences because the reader very much knows where they are. Sometimes it's dropping in synonyms, just the city instead.
Yeah, the city.
Often you'll find that actually I don't need another reference to that place in there if I just change the sentence in a certain way, just rework it slightly. Or you can refer to kind of very specific places within that, like we were within the alley, within the wind. So that can take away some of that sometimes. Yeah, I think if you have something in a piece which is unusual, such as a place name or a character name, and you're reading it out, it stands out more than anything else when you're reading it.
Definitely.
God, writing sections where two characters are having a conversation and also physically interacting with things and each other is nightmarish. You know, you get those, and then, you know, we'll call them Ben and Jeff because we might as well have a third Ben. Ben looked across the room at Jeff and said this, and then Jeff looked back and Jeff said, and then it was Ben that said, you're like, fuck, this is just awful. Control A, delete.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a case of that's not the bit you want to be writing. You want to be writing the next bit. So you just kind of keep going with it and you leave it in there. And then when you come back to it later, you just think, oh my word. And most of it just goes in the bin.
I definitely have been finding that, especially if you're trying to write a story like in order, sort of chronologically or however you want to say that, that you do sometimes hit a scene that you just do not want to write that day. Like if it's a big intense conversation between multiple people, you're like, oh, I kind of just want to write people kicking the shit out of each other on a battlefield today. I doing the nuances of conversation feels a bit beyond me. But then on other days, it's a bit like, oh no, let's really dig into this. So do you write in order, Ben, or do you, because you have a structure, do you write around whatever you want to write?
I do. I write. Yeah, chapter by chapter, whatever I've got to write that day, I write. And sometimes that means I kind of go off the plan. Think, well, actually, I want to write something a bit more exciting here before we get to that. Which it might mean I end up cutting some of that out or moving it around. But I try to stick very much to the order. I think perhaps my mood then dictates changing what that needs to be to some degree. Guy Fawkes was on his way from York to Durham, and it's a somewhat tedious journey. Back in the 1980s, like rather than 2 hours, it's like 3 days. So I was like, okay, I need something in here. So there are some additional demonic creatures encountered in a wood. So it's like, well, that'll go in there because I'm not just going to write him traveling there or just
could have bypassed the whole thing. Something weird about the M6 toll. I knew there was something demonic going on there.
Certainly is.
Straight into Good Omens territory now, haven't we?
Well, if you actually link up all the toll booths in the UK, they do make an enormous peanut.
Thank you very much for that bit of feedback. I really enjoyed listening to both of your works in progress as well. I think we sort of possibly did show like different elements of how a work in progress can look as well, which is really fun.
Yeah.
But in terms of NaNoWriMo itself, where did you first hear about it, Benjamin?
A long time ago. I can't remember when I did the first one, but it was over 10 years ago now, possibly 2008. I think I just stumbled upon the concept in a writing group that I used to be in. And I think I've had this is my fifth turn at it since then. So yeah, I don't know when it started, but certainly my first was a long time ago now.
But through a writer's group, so this, because I think it did start in North America, didn't it? But that means that it had already penetrated into an English writing group, even 10 years.
Yes, it was an online writer's group. I can't remember what the community was called. It was a UK-based group, and somebody there must have aware of it and shared that that's what they were going to do, and at that time I'd written a novel before, so I thought, well, that seems like an idea of something to do next. It was awful, the first one.
It's spread phenomenally, hasn't it?
Like, it has,
considering
yeah.
It, the amount of people that must have tried to start things like this, I'm always fascinated by why that one. What was it that kicked that one into overdrive? If you know, answers on a postcard.
On a postcard, yeah. I mean, the concept that everyone's got a book in them, I think it is true. And so this is a fairly interesting way to begin the extraction process.
I've met some people who have most ever takeaway menu in them.
They're allowed to dictate it if they want to.
Yeah, fair enough.
Everyone has a book in them, but some people need a ghostwriter. That's what we're saying.
Yeah.
Need to kill them to get out of them.
It's a rope and a chair. We've all seen Casino Royale.
Oh, amazing. So you've obviously got loads of completed works under your belt now. But have you actually won NaNoWriMo before? So winning NaNoWriMo is 50,000 words, 1 month in November. Have you won it?
So yes. Yeah. I'll tell you about some of those times. funnily enough,
like not straight. Yes.
Yeah. The only time I didn't complete was about 5 years ago. And funnily enough, that ended up being one of my published novels. First go, which must have been maybe 12 years ago, I was trying to write something kind of attacking celebrity culture. It was a novel called Gossip, and the concept of it was that this woman suddenly started having prophetic dreams about very minor things that certain celebrities were doing, and using these dreams she was able to get a job writing for a gossip column, and everything she was writing came true, and it was awful, but I like to think that it kind of taught me a lot about kind of what not to do.
It's got a big Ben Elton vibe to it, hasn't
I think it sounds pretty juicy.
I mean, it had its potential, but when I kind of read it back, some of the flaws, like I started with this character who was in an unhappy marriage. She had a child, and then the child just disappeared. I just stopped mentioning the child. And I was like, things like that, which I think you kind of learn from those kind of experiences.
You need to go back to that book and cut to her withered, mummified child in the corner that she forgot about. Oh yeah, I've got a kid.
Yeah. Once she started writing for the papers, that child starved. That's bleak.
Go on, sorry.
And then the second go, I got to 50,000 words, but the planned story that I had, I was only about 20% of the way through it. I just massively overwrote everything. I think I was very concerned that I was going to have not enough. And then everything was really, really, really overdone. That one was, oh God, it was a kind of almost a mock footballer's biography. And it had a ridiculous story about how he ended up crashing in some country in an aeroplane and losing his memory and coming back and being a star again. And it was so overblown, over the top. It had some awful sex scenes in it. It was terrible.
Please tell me you've still got some of them.
I may have.
To hear some of those at some point.
You're coming up. Right, I will do you a deal. I think we should all write really bad sex scenes.
I wrote one today.
I think I could. I'll try and find it. I've probably got some erotica I wrote as a teenager somewhere. This could be phenomenal.
I just got this image of this concussed footballer banging somebody in some backwater country somewhere with amnesia. It sounds amazing.
There was a phone sex. Oh God! Scene. He was away on some pre-season tour. In a phone box outside. Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
I am so hard for you, he typed, but it took ages because one hand was on his knob.
Oh, awful. So,
when you're undergoing these endeavours of gossip columnists, and were you the Daily Star at some point in a previous life? So you've got your gossip columnists and your amnesiac footballers.
I, It's an odd one. I don't know where it come from. I think I was reading kind of a lot of Chuck Palahniuk and kind of things which were kind of very transgressive, counterculture and whatnot. And I thought, this is the way I'm going to tear them down. Yeah.
So when you're creating these bizarre and glorious masterworks, do you use any of the community stuff that's actually on the NaNoWriMo site or any of it in person? Because I know there's a lot of groups and sort of squadding up is part of the challenge. Do you take part in that?
What I think can be quite useful is some of the Twitter accounts which start sprints. So they'll say, right, from a certain time, you're going to write for 30 minutes. And I think that can sometimes just stop me from procrastinating too much and just getting on with that. And sometimes these don't tend to be quite as helpful, but they'll say, put a prompt in there and try to use a character that does something. And I think that can be quite handy if you're really stuck with something. I mean, this time I've got such a thorough plan that I don't think that's likely, but can see how that can be helpful. And I do kind of like the little graph where you can see the line when you put your word count in and you can see how far above or below it you are. And I think that just helps.
I like a good graph.
Should mine have a dip at day four? I feel like I've fucked up.
Oh, no, seriously. Day one was 4,000 something, but that was a Monday when I don't work. Day two, Tuesday, 1,100. Yesterday, about 600. So, but, I mean, but then Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I should hope. Hopefully, I'll get back above the line again.
Oh, it's so that it now has, I don't know whether it used to have this, but there is a feature on it now where you can put you can select which emoji best applies to how you felt whilst you were writing, which is hilarious. But I assume you end up with like an aggregate emoji.
So you are supposed to, but mine still says you're a closed book. I'm assuming everyone else is at that stage still.
No, mine's just got like a smiley face on it.
Mine does not.
Oh, amazing.
My aggregate emotion is a shotgun. That's the
from last year. I think last year was the first time I'd seen this feature. You could put on time you started writing and the time you finished writing each session. And it would give you kind of a writing speed, how many words hour you were doing. But I don't even put on the totals so far this year rather than the writing speed. But yeah, that's kind of interesting too.
I don't need to know a writer at snail's pace.
I was sort of wondering about that because the time that you start and the time that you end doesn't include all those times where you're just sort of thinking about what you're going to write. And then currently then just sort of blitzing out a paragraph or two and then being like, and then, you know, if there is a stopping and starting nature, then you're going to have a much slower, seemingly a much slower writing speed, even if you're typing speed. It seems a bit irrelevant, doesn't it?
Is there anyone who just sits down and says, I shall write for 30 minutes and then consistently produces words? Because that's horrifying. You're meant to sit, you sit down and you write three sentences and you go, I don't know where this scene's going. And then you look and it's been 48 minutes and you haven't stopped. You go, all right, I guess that happened then. And then you don't write anything for a while. That's healthy, right?
Yeah, I get that a lot. And then it's that time when you realise you've only got an hour or so left before you have to be somewhere. And that's when the words come.
that's the real way they should tease words out of you in these writing groups and stuff. Put like false things in your diary.
I tell you what, the 30 minutes after my lunch break has ended at work is some of my best writing time.
Yeah.
I'll just finish this paragraph. That I call it that time.
Oh, that's great. So this sort of challenge nature of NaNoWriMo, does that end up making a difference in the way that you normally approach producing work? Or is it quite similar, or how's it been for you?
I think reflecting on kind of last year's experience, last year, let's say that Pseudonym took over for the month and produced a ridiculous action thriller. with very little of a plan. So with that, it was just a case of, I don't know what I'm doing here. It's a genre I've not written before. So I felt kind of like a newcomer again. And that was very much like, well, I have to write something today if I'm going to get there. And I did end up with 54,000 words at the end of that, and it hadn't quite reached the end of the novel. I ended up finishing it off over the summer and then self-publishing it under this pseudonym. But that was really a case of, well, you've got to do something, rather than just letting it go.
It's fascinating.
Oh, man. So where can we find the works of Lenjamin Bangley? That's my question.
I'm not sure if I can say.
Oh God.
Yeah. I don't think I can make this public knowledge because there are other plans for him which could probably get me fired.
Oh my word.
Excellent. No, yeah, we'll keep that closely guarded secret then.
Maybe that'll be an off-air
pornographer.
No. Mind you. That does have one of those scenes which is particularly awful. Sex scene which reads like a horrendous experience for everybody involved.
She grasped at her own pendulous breasts.
there was one that Morrissey won the worst sex scene written that year. This was like 7 years ago at this stage. But at one point, a woman refers to her own gyroscopic breasts, which is possibly the most bonkers thing anyone has put on paper ever.
The piece I wrote contained the phrase rigidity in motion.
oh, that's spicy.
There's one doing the rounds at the moment from Giles Corran from Winkler.
His knob rattling off her teeth and jumping around like a shower head in a bath.
It sounds like the man has no control over his own penis, which is problematic for everyone.
There was a documentary that he made, I think it was called My Failed Novel, about his experience of writing it and its lack of sales and whatnot. And he gets to listen in to a book group who are discussing it, and it's kind of entertaining.
Really, it's a death knell for us, because as he said, there is no place in novel writing for men.
That's just ridiculous.
Listen, Giles, if you want to come on,
we'll definitely have him on.
I'd fucking love that.
It'd be amazing. I was just about to read out a section of this one that's been going around, and I realised the whole thing's one bloody sentence. It's a paragraph. It's one sentence.
Read me the run-on sentence.
I can't read the whole thing. It's so fucking long. but like. I'll read you a little bit. There you go. It's got the bit about the shower. There you go. And he came again so hard that his dick wrenched out of her hand, and a shot of it hit him straight in the eye and stung like nothing had ever been in there. And he yelled with the pain, and the yell could have been anything. And as she grabbed at his dick, which was leaping around like a shower dropped in an empty bath, she scratched at his back so deeply with the nails of both hands, and he shot three more times in thick stripes across her chest. Like Zorro.
I've got a question. How many arms has this woman got? Because she scratched his back with both hands while grabbing at his dick. That's incredible.
How many dicks has he got?
The question is not how many dicks, it's how many loads is this man carrying? That's the size of his scrotum.
A ram. It's like a ram's bollock.
It's like a space hopper full of yogurt. Like Zorro.
So that was actually the like Zorro bit. I think I've defamed this man, because that was actually another sentence. That was a simple sentence at the end of this run-on sentence.
Oh well.
Just the words like Zorro full stop. Oh, impactful writing. Love it.
Adding like Zorro to the end of everything you write to increase your word count. Have you got any tips for people like me, nano virgins, who are, you know, looking to get it done?
I think sometimes it's a case of thinking about, right, well, who can come through the door next that's going to keep things moving along? So it might be a kind of a returning character. Somebody else can come back that can move things along. Or indeed, just go back to the old, let's throw another obstacle in the way to make this as hard as possible for these characters to succeed. That can help expand the scene as not just for the sake of doing so, but in order to ramp up the tension too, to kind of make it that much harder for them to reach their goals.
That makes a lot of sense. It's a strange thing, isn't it? Just trying to shove all these words out of your brain. So any of these little tips and tricks are really worthwhile having, I think. Have you got any other experiences of Nanarima that you think might be useful or interesting?
I think really it's just a case of, certainly from last year, I had a similar situation last year where I only really had up until about the 23rd then. And it's just a case of when the words are coming, keep going at those times. And when they're not, drag out as many as you can. but it's a case of, you know, don't give up too quickly. And sometimes you just have to realise that, yeah, this bit is nonsense, but it's going to get me back to the good bit. It's going to get me back to the exciting stuff. And you might find out that several months down the line when you're editing this, you take out that clunky paragraph and just replace it with the word later. Yeah. That's what you needed to do at the time to get there.
Yeah.
I think if I was going to say anything, it would be already try and do it every day. Because like Sam Vime says, if you'd miss it for a good reason, then very quickly you'd start missing it for a bad reason.
Mm.
And I think I can see it being really easy to fall off of this.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Last year, I attempted it for the first time, and we've spoken a bit about that before on this podcast. But I started, because I was putting out 2,000-3,000 words a day, you know, not easily, but like I was capable of doing it. You know, the words were flowing, so I didn't stop, as you just said, Benjamin. I then started taking weekends off, and it actually made it really hard towards the end of the month when my, you know, when a bit of fatigue set in and I wasn't hitting the heights of, you know, 2-3k a day during the week, to then still be taking weekends off was really putting too much pressure on myself towards the end. Unnecessarily so, because little and often works very well with this. But then again, I think everyone's different. So, you know, if it works for people to do it a different way, then they should. But from my experience, I totally agree, Nick. I think it's so every day.
The one fucking lunatic that wrote 50,000 words on day one. Who are you?
I just don't even know how that's feasible. I think if I was writing from midnight to midnight, it would be I just don't think I could do it. That's,
I think Bolivian march words an hour plus necessary. You know, some kind of chemical assistance.
Reckon you could do it. I don't think it would be a good story.
Well, no,
but that's the thing, isn't it? Like, the sort of the point isn't necessarily for it to be good. I know that's a bit sort of blasphemous, but that's sort of what I was saying earlier about the piece that I read out. Like, I don't feel like the bit that I read out just now is very good. I think it's got some decent bits in it. I think it's got some potential, but you know, as you said earlier, Benjamin, like sometimes you need to just write the bit in order to get to the next good bit, and then sometimes you're going to be cutting things out, like. It's at the end of the day, this challenge is all about just the word count for me, and then afterwards it's about polishing it and turning it into a second draft, a third draft, edging towards that final draft where you can actually put it in front of someone and be like, would you like this?
Yeah, this is about getting it written, not about getting it right. It's because you can't make something better that isn't there. And nobody's going to write a perfect first draft. So you're always going to need to go back into it. And I think sometimes you can't really know the story fully till you've written the whole thing. Mm. So sometimes you can procrastinate over chapter one. And even if you get that perfect, you might then find that when you've written the ending, that there are things in there that have to go anyway, because it doesn't work story-wise anymore.
Yeah.
So for me, I have to have the whole thing down before I can go back and add it up.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we're on the page there. I tell you what, it's been absolutely really cathartic because we have been writing every day so far, and there's way more days of writing coming up. But it's been already really cathartic just to chat about it.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for your time and for coming on again and for giving us some really useful insights and also sharing something that's going to be excellent. So this book is with a publisher, isn't it? The one that you read.
That's
out.
Right. Yeah. Shadow Spark Publishing, who published my second novel, Is She Dead in Your Dreams? So yeah, I'm back with them again. The first one is scheduled for June, so got to turn in the first draft of that by the end of January. Actually, they won't be the first draft, it'll be like the third. Second book will be out on the 5th of November next year. So,
hey.
Yeah, I thought, well, we've got to have one of the books out on the 5th of November.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the final one should follow 5 months after that. That's the plan.
It's bloody brilliant.
Oh, it's exciting.
So I think people are already aware of you, but I'm really keen for you to keep plugging. So where can people find you? What can they read of yours? Where can they buy it? Everything.
So Twitter's probably the easiest one to find. _J_Langley. I come up as Benjamin Langley on there as well. There's a blog which I tend to keep up to date with. Mostly with what I'm reading, actually. I think that's Benjamin Langley Writer at WordPress. But if you just look up Benjamin Langley Writer, that will show up there. On Amazon, you can pick up all of my novels. The cheapest thing to get is my novella, The Fenwitch of Goosefeather Split, which is a mere 77p, the cheapest that Amazon allows you to sell something for. And that's
good
kind
as
of
well.
Thank you. So yeah, and occasionally I make it available for free. You're only allowed to do that 5 days every 3 months. Thank you, Amazon.
But if you're listening and you're interested in Ben's work, go and buy it for 77p, you cheapskate.
If you are listening at home and you're writing along as well, we do have a group on NaNoWriMo's website called The Tiny Bookcase. So feel free to join us in there if you need a little bit of oomphing along, or you just want to tell us that what we read out was crap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just asking to be punched there, really, aren't you? It's a bit of masochism to end the show.
I want you to hurt me, Snake.
All right, thank you very much, Benjamin. And everyone, do go and follow Langley and read his stuff, because it's excellent. And he's an excellent dude. So thank you again.
Cheers.
Bye now. Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Tiny Bookcase.
Remember to subscribe, otherwise you're going to miss out on the future fun.
Also, tell a friend. If you like this episode, link them to it.
We'd be tremendously grateful. You can follow us on Twitter at BookcaseTiny, Facebook at The Tiny Bookcase, and Instagram at Bookcase Tiny for updates.
Speaking of supporting the podcast, well, magic can only take one so far. The Tiny Bookcase is supported by the generosity of its patrons. Those kind souls have really kept my belly full the last year. Let's cast a spell for them, shall we? For magnificent beardery, let's cast the Chinicus Folliculari spell on Gary Laird. For rich ginger tones on their scalp, let us cast the Orangi Hedondo spell for Scott Byrne. And for general fabulousness, why not the Ooh-la-la, la, How's Your Mother spell on Matthew McLaren?
How do you come up with that shit, man?